Call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. The time is 1:30 p.m. It is Monday, March 6, 2016. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Chloe Miller from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to please remind committee members to and those in the room to please silence your cell phones, especially the committee chair. Present today, Senator Tilton, Senator Stevens, Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. The first item on our agenda is House Bill 93, Residency Requirements Hunting, Trapping, Fishing, sponsored by Representative Hemshute. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Before hearing from the bill's sponsored office, I would like first to look to the will of the committee to adopt work draft version I as our working document. Senator Tobin, could I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill 93, Work Draft 34-LS0058 as our working document.
Thank you. I'll object for purposes of discussion. Here to explain the summary of changes is our Senate Judiciary Committee aide, Brianna Kakarik. If you are ready forward, please put yourself on the record and begin your summary.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brianna Kakarik, and I'm staff to Senator Klayman. So from version to end to version I, there's been a new Section 5 added. The new Section 5 amends AS 4323008 subsection A relating to allowable absences for purposes of permanent fund dividend eligibility. This section adds a new allowable absence category permitting an otherwise eligible individual to remain eligible for a dividend while absent from the state if the individual is serving as a pilot for United States Airlines certified as an air carrier by the Federal Aviation Administration. And then there's conforming changes made out through this section because of this change. And then there's a new effective date of January 1st, 2028. And as a result of the new Section 5, there will be a title change. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions with regard to the committee substitute? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just curious on the definition of air carrier. Would that include folks who fly for UPS or Alaska Airlines, or what is included in air carrier?
I don't 100% know that answer, so I'll have to get back to you, or maybe look to one of the there's Ledge Legal on the line who may be able to answer that, or one of the other Q&A people available.
Actually, we have an invited testimony today from the Government Affairs Committee Chair of the Airline Pilots Association. My bet is that he can answer that question. And if you can hold that till we get to invited testimony.
I will, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no other questions, I'm going to remove my objection to the committee substitute. And seeing no other objections, version I is now adopted as a working document. Here to present the bill is Representative Hemshute and her staff, Thatcher Brower. Representative Hemshute and Mr. Brower, if you'd please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and you can begin your remarks. And if you know the answer to Senator Tilton's question, you can tell us now, too.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. Thank you for having us back. I'm Rebecca Hemshute. I represent House District 2 here in Southeast Alaska, and with me is my staff.
Thatcher Brower, staff representative Hemshute.
I don't have the exact answer, but I did in another document. So there is a place where that is clearly defined as far as the air carriers. So that can be looked up and confirmed through a particular website that I can't recall the name of, but there is a repository for that.
Hello?
Senator Tilton. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just curious, because I know that you've been working with this particular advocacy group, pilot versus first mate or the crew, does this affect other folks who are actually supporting a pilot in their endeavors?
Through the chair, I can't answer that with 100% certainty, so I think I would defer to the invited testimony on that.
Thank you.
All right. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. I hadn't really prepared any remarks. I came more prepared to answer questions. I will say that the new effective date is a desired change, And I think including pilots makes a lot of sense to me as well. So I have no concerns with the CS, but the delayed effective date is really important as Alaskans adjust to this new standard. It allows folks who've already planned their calendar for 2027 not to have the rug pulled out. So it gives folks time to adjust and be able to meet that standard of 180 days.
Thank you. I have a series of questions that I warned you were coming about the constitutional questions that some have asked. The first one is, does the right to hunt and fish have a higher level of constitutional interest than the economic question or the economic interest in a dividend, which the courts have already described as a low interest in constitutional analysis?
Thank you, Chair Clayman, and to the committee. Rebecca Hemshoot, for the record. I have been learning about this myself. My understanding is there is a sliding scale of interests. And so you can have a fundamental interest, like your right to breathe air and your right to vote are fundamental interests. And then you have a lower level interest, such as receiving a payment from the government, which is a dividend payment, not an entitlement, but a lower level interest. And between those two is the right to hunt and fish, because it is addressed in the Constitution, Article 8. So it's somewhere between the less defined constitutional role of the dividend and the fundamental right to vote. So between those two is where this falls.
Okay. You actually answered the second question, so we'll go on to the third question. The second question was, where does the right to hunt and fish fit on the scale? And the answer is between whether or not it's a right to a dividend, the interest in a dividend is lower than the right to hunt and fish, and lower than the right to hunt and fish is lower than the right to vote.
And I'll add, Chair Clayman, if you talk to Alaskans about this bill, that right to hunt and fish in the minds of Alaskans is a higher right than the dividend, at least a higher interest for residents.
So what is the state's interest, or what state interest justifies treating a state resident who is absent for more than 180 days differently from a resident who was not absent from the state for more than 180 days for purposes of the right to hunt and fish?
Thank you for the question, Rebecca Hemshoot, House District 2. And I'll just, I think, begin by reminding the committee that we already have a different standard in our bag limits and our license fees, and that standard has been set by statute, but also by Board of Fish and Board of Game policy. So what this bill is about is the enforceability of that standard. So the state's interest is really in providing enforceability to an already different standard. So we've already established that we have a preferential bag limit for residents, but we don't have an enforceable way of fulfilling that, I guess, state interest. So what we're getting at with this bill is making it an enforceable standard. And the other thing I would mention is, and I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but
you probably are, but go ahead.
Folks who are living here year round, I know where I live, that full freezer can make the difference between staying and leaving. So your ability to feed your family from the land is an Alaskan thing. And if you are here for more than 180 days, you are going to need that freezer full of fish and game resources.
So the next question is, if the right to hunt and fish has a higher level of interest than the interest in a dividend, why pair a higher level of interest, meaning the interest in the right to fish and game, with the interest in a dividend? And why pair those two together?
Thank you.
Now we're putting the fish and game has higher interest. Yep.
Thank you. It's another great question to the chair, Rebecca Hemshoot, House District 2. The dividend standard, of the dividend enforcement has been tested over time in the courts, and we've arrived at not only a court-tested standard, but also we've allowed for exemptions. And in fact, we've changed those exemptions. We've added to those exemptions even as recently as last year, we added to the exemptions. So there are 17 different exemptions, and with today's CS, there would be 18 different exemptions available to Alaskans. So it's been something that has, I guess, stood the test of time and withstood the courts.
And the last question is, what is the purpose of requiring residents be absent from Alaska for less than 180 days in the prior to, wait a second. What is the purpose for requiring that residents be absent from Alaska for less than 180 days in the prior year in order to engage in non-commercial harvest as a resident of the state's fish and game? What's special about being here more than 180 days?
Thank you for that question. Again, these bag limits have already been set through statute and through policy. And so the what we're doing with this bill is we're not saying that you're in a special class of citizen. Anybody can choose to be here for 180 days. So with that in mind, it's really about helping Alaskans who are trying to feed their families keep their freezers full. But we're not saying that someone can't do that. Everyone is welcome to be here and to hunt and fish as a resident for at least 180 days. With exemptions, it could be you could be out of state more than 180 days if you're out for an allowable exemption.
Okay. Any other questions from the group? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the questions that Senator Tobin had about pilots. I have nothing against pilots. I mean, they're wonderful people. But why are we being so generous to them? I mean, we're talking about 6 months, right? Pilots come and go, I'd assume. Alaska Airlines pilots is the only ones I know of. They come and go. They come back to Alaska, leave Alaska. If they're gone for more than 6 months, that seems really unusual. And then also, I think we need to answer the question that Senator Tobin brought up about, does this include everyone else on the airplane that works for the company as well?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Stevens. I think the reason it does make sense for pilots, I've had to learn about this, but your duty station may not be Anchorage. So you may commute to Seattle as your duty station, which already adds a day of sort of commute time on either end. And then you might serve for 2 weeks flying in the lower 48 and then come home to Alaska. And one could argue there's a bit of a choice being made there because we have lots of pilot jobs in Alaska. Pilots make our state run, there's no doubt. But the other part of exempting pilots is their training. Often they're required to go out of state for training. And that training time can be a month at a time. So if you're flying for Delta or United or even Alaska these days and your route takes you out of state plus your training time, although the training time would fit under the exemption, I believe, for school, for education. So it does add up, though. And these, while there are pilot jobs in the state, you could be an in-state pilot and taken out of state for your work.
After 6 months, I wonder if you're even a citizen of Alaska.
Well, and there are, I'm going to defer to my staff person here, how many different, there's 26 different standards of residency. So there's the voting standard and the right to in-state tuition and homesteading, and each one of those has a different standard.
And are those 26 different states in Alaska? This isn't other states, 26 different standards for residency in Alaska?
Correct. I haven't looked at all the different definitions in other states, but I'm sure they're numerous.
Any follow-up, Senator Stevens? I jumped in on one of
you. No, that's fine. Jump in all you want. I just seems to be extremely generous, and I just don't quite buy it. Sorry.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any other questions. Also available, if there are questions, Alpheus Bullard, Legislative Counsel from Legislative Legal is available, Major Aaron Frenzel, Alaska Department of Public Safety, and Joe Felkel, Deputy Director, Division of Administrative Services, Department of Fish and Game. Thank you. We have also asked Representative McCabe, who is the sponsor of House Bill 95, which is what is now incorporated into this bill, to provide an invited testifier to discuss the new provisions. So here for invited testimony, House Bill 295, and the provisions that are now in HB 93 is Burke Anderson. He's here somewhere. Yep, Burke Anderson, Government Affairs Committee Chair, Airline Pilots Association. Mr. Anderson, if you would put yourself on the record, I'll give you a couple of minutes to make some remarks, and then and if you can, in that those remarks, answer the questions you've already heard.
Certainly. Thanks for inviting me to speak on behalf of this Amendment for 93 and for all of your time and attention on this. Firstly, my name is Burke Anderson. I am a pilot for Alaska Airlines. Been at Alaska Airlines 7 years, and I'm also a lifelong Alaskan. I was born here, lived here my whole life. And today I'm speaking to you as a representative of the Airline Pilots Association. And we are the largest pilots union in the United States and Canada. And we represent 700 pilots here that are residents of the state of Alaska, of that 74,000 that we represent nationwide. And I'm calling primarily just to voice our support for this amendment to Bill 93, including us in the 180-day allowable absences provision. High level, we support it because we feel we shouldn't be penalized and have our work days counted against the 180-day absence period, just due to the nature of our job. Inherently, you know, we travel for work. You could say that our office moves. We drive into work and show up for our period of time at work, and it just so happens that our office is moving across the surface of the planet. It's not that, you know, we're intentionally wanting to be away from Alaska. It's just like many professions, which are included on this list, the nature of our work takes us away from the state. And so of these 700 people that my membership constitutes, these are Alaskans that make their lives here. Their home is here. Their jobs are here. Their vehicles are all here. This is where they're at. When we're on the road for work, we're not living there. It's not recreational. It's not intentional. It's just where our schedule takes us, which we have very little control over. There's a perception that we're primarily trying to be in state or out of state. That's not typically how this industry works, really, at all. There might be some special cases, but for the most part, flight crew have very little control over this stuff, where a typical schedule will take them over the course of a trip. So simply put, high level, we're not asking for special treatment by being added to the list. We're just asking for equal treatment as Alaskans that don't fit the clean definitions of what most people's work looks like, where they're in one spot. Given that the nature of our work is all over the place, we're just asking for equal treatment for the 180-day allowable absences. So we sort of see this provision as eliminating the gray area that we're currently operating in as flight crew. We just see adding this language as clearly making a clear definition of days that were spent outside of the state not counting towards that 180-day rule. There's certainly when one is on vacation or on absences that are elective, that should, just like any other Alaskan. But given the fact that we're simply at work with very little control of our schedule and where they send us, we're just asking for the equal treatment on that, and that our periods of time when we're at work in a work capacity not count against us.
One of the questions is, where is the Pilots Association in terms of flight crews?
I guess I don't understand the question. Can you say that again?
So one of the other questions that was asked, I think actually both by Senator Stevenson and Senator Tobin, what about flight attendants on the Alaska Airlines flight? Not the pilot, but they also are oftentimes many nights of the year away, but this exemption only applies to the pilots. Is there a reason why it doesn't apply to the flight crews?
The language of it as it currently stands, I would agree with that. It currently does say pilot. Personally, I would advocate that it does say flight crew, because the flight attendants, of which there's potentially living in, the latest numbers I have are right around 700 to 800 residents. They're in the exact same situation that pilots are in. So I can't speak that as you know, coming from a union perspective, from the Airline Pilots Association, but I can say that as an Alaskan resident, as a friend and co-worker of these folks, that including the language to read as flight crew would be inclusive.
And I think there was another question. Again, I don't mean to say it for Senator, but I think she specifically asked about what qualifies as an airline. Is UPS a United States airline? Is FedEx a United States airline? Is Atlas Air a United States airline?
Yes, that's a great question. So that's all defined by the Federal Aviation Administration, and all these airlines have an air carrier certificate. So if they're legally authorized to fly in U.S. airspace, they'll have an air carrier certificate. And that's not just airlines that are based in the United States. An air carrier certificate is actually also recognized internationally by the international regulatory body. And that's called ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization. But as far as the language of this amendment, by a United States airline, I would take that to be interpreted as an FAA-recognized an airline with an FAA-recognized air carrier certificate, which all of those, FedEx, UPS, Atlas, all do possess.
Well, very specifically, what about British Air? I assume they have an air carrier certificate, but...
They will have an air carrier certificate from their regulating body, from the, I guess it would be the Civil Aviation Administration, Aeronautics Authority, I want to say, in the UK. But ultimately, that's all recognized by ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization. So when you see these other airlines operating here in Alaskan airspace, like Korean Air or a bunch of the other China Southern Airways or whoever it may be, or Condor for that matter, all of these are internationally recognized air carriers.
But not a United States airline.
Well, that terminology, United States airline, if that's not an industry term per se, I would interpret that to read as an FAA, an airline with an FAA certificate. But as far as like the nuance of that specific language, I wouldn't be authorized to speak on that.
Senator Stevens, I know you had your hand up, and I apologize for
that. No, that's right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To sort of get perspective on this, Mr. Anderson, you're a pilot for Alaska Airlines. As a pilot for Alaska Airlines, have you ever been out of state for 6 months at a time?
In what area is the question? In 6 months at a time in one continuous block?
I think that's the way it works, doesn't it? Or because you can be gone for a while and come back, is it, and leave the next day, right? Do I have that correct? Maybe I better ask that of, but I think that's correct. You can be gone for 159 days, come back one day in Alaska, leave for another 159, as long as you check into Alaska. I think that's the way it works. Can anybody correct me there?
I personally haven't been gone more than a 180-day block, but there could be scenarios where one would be in the line of duty while at work. But moreover, we support the change so that 180-day total within a 365-day, we're just asking that it not count absences while we're at work, not count towards that 180-day maximum. That's sort of high level why we support this, because there would be potentially scenarios that various flight crew might exceed that 180 days. I can't speak to every single flight crew and every single person in this situation, but we're just asking for equal treatment. Time when you're on when you're gone on a vacation and an electric trip, absolutely that should count towards the 180 days. But when I show up to work, I am not intentionally being gone from
Mr. Anderson, let's put you on pause for a minute, because I think Senator Stevens is asking a question that is better asked by Alpheus Bullard, Legislative Counsel with Legislative Legal. Mr. Bullard, did you hear Senator Stevens' question about counting 180 days in the blocks and whatnot?
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee and Chairman Clinton, no, I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Senator Stevens, could you restate your question for Mr. Bullard?
I'd rather you restated it.
Okay. So the way Senator Stevens asked the question, he understands the 180-day period to be of a block of time of 180 days. And so the example would be a person is out of state for 159 days, comes back to Alaska for 3 days, and then goes back out of state for another 159 days. Does that mean they would still qualify under the 180 days, or does the 180 days get counted differently?
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, through Chairman Clyman, you know, you're asking about the Department of Revenue's interpretation of the allowable absence statute as it stands right now for purposes of the existing exemptions?
I believe so, yes.
you know, while the important answer is what the Department of Revenue provides, I think as I read the statute, that it says, do not exceed 180 days in addition to any absence or cumulative absences. So I would read the 180 days not as a block, but as a aggregate. And I am looking at 17A of 4323008.
And I would note that the Department of Revenue is not with us today, but we will be sure to have them at our next hearing to see whether their interpretation is the same as what we're hearing from Legal. Senator Stevens, any follow-up on that question?
No, I think it's an important thing to know, sort of foundational here. It's a pain in the neck. I mean, I'm retiring soon, and I want to travel more, and I've always thought that I didn't realize it's 180 days, so you have to be in Alaska 6 months, and you can be gone for 6 months. That doesn't seem to be particularly a difficult thing for me to do. I don't know why it's so difficult for pilots to do.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to ask Mr. Anderson, can you tell me how many members of your association are men or identify as men?
I wouldn't have access to that.
Well, I would be interested to know, Mr. Chairman, as I anticipate the difference between flight attendants and pilots is a gender breakdown that's pretty significant. And as Mr. Anderson had said multiple times, this is about fairness. I think we'd want to ensure that the entire flight crew would be considered underneath these statutes. However, I do note here that there's also an additional statute around page 4, lines, let's see, 18, 19, and 20, that also would include the spouses of anyone who is exempted in this section, which gives me significant pause, because that would also mean that Mr. Anderson's spouse could leave the state for up to 180 days if they were accompanying him on any travel, all along with dependent children. Is that something that often happens, Mr. Anderson? Do you see a lot of spouses and dependent children follow their pilots, parental guardian or spouse on their travels?
I can't speak to all situations that various flight crew would find themselves in, but I can speak to extended training periods, which would also fall under the definition of us being at work for an air carrier. Those potentially would be a situation in which a spouse and or children might relocate for an extended period of time. Typically, these training periods could last potentially up to 3 months or longer in some cases. So that there certainly are scenarios in which the families of flight crew might go along with them and be out of state. Again, I want to reiterate that these training events are outside of our control. These training centers are, again, are federally regulated and typically located outside of Alaska. So this isn't elective travel. And then just to Senator Stevens' comment about it being difficult potentially or not difficult for us to be in Alaska 180 days, I just wanted to remind the senator that we're asking that these days when we are outside of the state of Alaska for work not be counted towards that 180-day aggregate.
Follow up.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to confirm with the bill sponsor that these sections that we are amending to include pilots don't just pertain to hunting licenses. They also include to PFD eligibility. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Rebecca Himshute, House District 2. Actually, if I understand correctly, it goes right into the dividend statute. And that would be, in my opinion, the appropriate place for these exemptions to be added if they are added, because then those will apply in House Bill 93 going forward.
A follow-up?
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. I'd be very curious, as I know this is a work draft, but I'd be curious on the fiscal impact. We're talking now about pilots, their spouses, and dependents. We just heard the invited testifier talk about how there may be some changes, and this 180 days would be in addition to any family travel that they might do. So they could be out of state for not only 6 months, but if they chose to use their flight benefits and leave for another 3 months, they would not be in the state for 9 months, and yet they would receive a PFD in addition to hunting privileges. And I'm still struggling why we wouldn't allow that for the entire flight crew or potentially other professions.
Through the chair, my sense is it's a little bit more difficult to identify who flight crew are, but provided there's a way to do that, then I would agree this exemption should apply to flight crew as well.
And follow up?
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. My other question is, I have a good friend who's an engineer on a Crowley ship. He goes and does long pulls to Hawaii quite frequently. He also has lost his PFD eligibility. And I'm curious why you didn't think of folks who have those type of professions, who are based here in Alaska and yet travel for work, but don't necessarily have the ability to call into some of our sessions and advocate or have an entity that will advocate on their behalf.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, it's not that we didn't think of those folks. If they're not in the Merchant Marine, then there may be another exemption required.
Thank you.
Just a note on that topic, Senator Tobin. One of the discussions we've had in my office was about people that are in the Merchant Marine context, and that was actually an amendment to Section 4323008, subsection A, that passed in the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so paragraph, and I was researching it this morning, subparagraph 1, 2, 3, and 4 of that section 5 in the bill is the amendment that was seeking to address the folks working in the Merchant Marine context, which is why, for purposes of this amendment, we did not add any language about them. If you feel like your colleague or friend that is on ships is not covered by what's in 1, 2, 3, and 4, then that might be something we need to look at further, because that my understanding has been that a person in exactly what you described is now covered in those four subsections.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, it doesn't take someone who's training to get their tourism six-pack. So there are definitely professions that people choose to be in that they understand that they will lose certain benefits as they go through potentially the training process, the credentialing process. It's a part of the option of choice of employment. My husband is also a pilot. However, he chooses to stay here in state and get his training here in state. So there's all sorts of different options that folks can exercise, and there are consequences of those choices.
Any other questions? And Senator Tobin, I know you were asking the person from the Pilots Association about spouses. Did you want to ask any questions about legislative legal counsel on that topic?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, and I know that we don't have anyone from Ledge Finance here, but I'd be very curious about the idea of folks who are not actually employed underneath the statute but have a relationship to the person who is exempt, and what would be the constitutional balance of that? As we had a long conversation earlier about the idea of where is the barometer on the constitutional protection of folks who meet a high barrier or bar to residency, and if it's a person who is not necessarily employed but a spouse, where would that fall?
And through the chair to Senator Tobin, I think it's an interesting question. And Rebecca Hamshute, for the record, I would I think it would be helpful to have somebody from the dividend division with us to clarify, because you can be gone more than 180 days for certain allowances as well. So there are lots of ways to look at the dividend statute, which is not the area that I've been looking at too deeply. I've been looking more at the hunting and fishing side of things. So I think there's more discussion on that possible.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I've mentioned before, I did lose my PFD eligibility when I was serving an extended service in the Peace Corps, which again was a choice because I was not able to come back to the state for the requisite 72 hours. I was not able to keep my permanent fund dividend for that following year. But that is the dynamics of the statutes and how they interplay, and then also the choices that people make within them.
And through the chair, I did a fellowship at the National Science Foundation through an academic year plus a couple months and lost 2 years of dividend then I had to requalify. So that was a choice I made, and I was appalled. I thought, I'm coming back a better teacher for the effort I made and for the sacrifice I made to leave. But that was, again, a choice.
Well, sort of unrelated, but one of the cultural features of in the world that is reflected by Senator Tobin's question. I have a friend in his part of his career was as a captain of Middle Eastern flagged oil tankers. And unlike U.S. and other flagged oil tankers, there's a general expectation because many of the Middle Eastern flagged captains have more than one wife. There's an expectation that they will always have at least one of their wives on the vessel. And so that my friend who only had one wife and she traveled with him extensively, and there was an expectation on these tankers that, of course, your spouse is with you because all the captains had spouses with them. We do not have space on the airline in the pilot's cabin for spouses to be riding. And we all know that, but it's an interesting cultural difference because I would be quite surprised to find a U.S. flag vessel that had specifically identified space for the spouse on the ship. Anyway, that doesn't require an answer, but it's an interesting observation about some of the questions Senator Tobin has. Any other questions for Mr. Anderson? Hearing and seeing none. Any other questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or her staff?
Hearing and Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
Just the issue of United States Airlines. I'm not sure we've come to a conclusion. Are you willing to change that? Do you think you need to change that? Omit that? Because, as you say, there could be a Alaska pilot working on British Airways.
Senator Stevens, I actually think that's a very good question. So right now, I think there's three questions that we need answered the next time we hear the bill. One is fiscal impacts, and part A of fiscal impacts is fiscal impacts for adding pilots. And part B, even though it's not part of it, I'm hearing concerns from members of the committee that what about flight attendants? I tend to think the flight attendants, many of whom are unionized, probably have as good an idea of their schedule as the pilots have. And so there's two parts of the fiscal. One is pilots, one is flight attendants. And if we added flight crew, meaning flight, and that would include flight attendants, what are the fiscal impacts, both with just pilots and what happens if you add flight attendants? The second is I would want the Department of Revenue to give us their perspective on how the days are counted, which is response to your question. And the third question, which I don't quite know who we should get the answer from, but I think we need the answer, is what is a United States airline as distinct from, because I think a pilot for Alaska Airlines, whatever United States airline is, I'm sure that counts. I'm not sure that British Airlines should be counted as a United States airline, even though they fly in the United States. And the notion that a person that's based in Alaska somehow becomes a pilot for British Airlines and shuttles over to London and then flies around for whatever period and then shuttles back to Alaska. I'm not quite sure if British Air qualified as a United States airline. I'm not sure where I'd fall on that, but I think we need clarification on that. And I'll hope the bill sponsor's office can help us figure out the right folks to ask.
Have to.
Are there other questions that we should add to the list? All right, and Senator Keel joined us at about 2:05, if my watch on the clock was accurate. Nothing else from the bill sponsor. With nothing further, we will set House Bill 93 aside for further review. Second and last item on our agenda is Senate Bill 241, Consumer Fee Transparency, sponsored by Senator Scott Kawasaki. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Senator Kawasaki and his staff, Joe Hayes. Senator Kawasaki and Mr. Hayes, please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'll be brief and then allow Mr. Hayes to go through the sectional and supporting documents. Senate Bill 241 adds a section to the statute which outlines unlawful or deceptive practices for business, making it unlawful for businesses to advertise, display, or offer a price for goods or services to a consumer that does not display mandatory fees or other charges apart from government taxes like a sales tax. Various states across the United States have introduced similar legislation over the years, what's often referred to as junk fees or mandatory charges that are tacked on at the end of a transaction that have no legitimate purpose to neither the business nor the consumer. Consumers have spent billions and billions of dollars on junk fees. And I read one article that says it's roughly $3,000 a year per person. It's highly necessary to establish this within state law to promote full transparency in trade and consumer relations to protect the rights and interests of consumers. The American economy has become overrun with junk fees. These charges harm both businesses and consumers. To maintain a competitive, fair market, actions must be taken to make these charges unlawful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hayes, are you up next?
Oh, I should have said for the record, Scott Kawasaki, District P from Fairbanks.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki, and I will do the sectional analysis. It's a very quick section. Also, Section 1 amends AS 4550471B by adding Section 5.8 that makes it unlawful for a business to advertise or display a price that does not include all mandatory fees or charges apart from government taxes. Section 2 will establish this legislation in July 1 of 2026.
Any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or his staff? I have a question for whichever one of you wants to answer. One of the restaurants is in the Anchorage Airport. Now has a paper sign near where you pay, and it specifically says, if you pay in cash, you'll get a 3% discount. So describe the impact of this bill in terms of one is standing at this business, and they're offering me 3% off if I pay cash, and obviously not getting 3% off if I pay with a credit card. Does this change what that transaction looks like?
Through the chair, Joe Hayes, Senator Staff to Senator Kawasaki. Yes, because that's a hidden fee right now. So the only time you would see that is when you came up as the paper saying that you have to pay X amount extra. So with the passage of this bill, there would be no hidden fee. So you would know upfront that if you go to the airport, you'll pay whatever the equivalent would be for credit card versus what the dollar amount would be if it was just cash.
So what that would mean is if I own the restaurant in the airport and I'm charging $10 for a sandwich, if the customer pays with a credit card, if the bank is charging me, the owner, a fee for the credit card processing, what would happen is they would charge the charge with a credit card would be $10 plus 3%, so $10.30. So I'd pay $10.30 for the sandwich, and if I paid cash, I'd pay $10, and that's the effect of this bill.
Through the chair, Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki, that would be the effect of this bill for something like a sandwich, but then you run into things like Airbnbs where they might say that you owe $100 and then you pay $100 and then you find out that you have $200 in additional fees, which would be the junk fees that you didn't know about, the hidden fees.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think I understand the credit card fees. I mean, it makes sense because the business is being charged that to use your credit card. So I don't know that would be considered a junk fee, the credit card fees. But if not that, what are the junk fees? You specifically, you can give some examples that I might recognize that have paid and now I'm upset about it.
Through the chair, Joe Hayes, staff Senator Kawasaki. So from the American Economic Liberty Project, we have a nice handy guide, State Lawmaker's Guide to Common Junk Fees. And it breaks down auto sales, cable bills, carpet cleaning services, cell phone bills, food delivery, hotels, live event ticketing, rents, rental car, moving trucks, restaurant dining, storage units, travel booking sites, utilities.
So, through the chair, Senator Scott Kawasaki, Senator Stevens. So The fees are like the dock fees that you would pay from a car auto dealer, the document fees that are added to the to a bill that are that don't translate to anything that you're getting. It would be the surcharge that you would pay at a restaurant for dining, even though there's not a, you know, a gratuity that's established under like a 8-person per table kind of rule. We've seen these in point of sale machines where a person comes to a point of sale machine, they pay for their bill, and it has a whatever fee gets tacked on with no discussion on what it is. And I think that Senator or Representative McCabe actually commented on this last year about this convenience fee that was attached to a bill, even though he was the person that went through the line and bought the thing and then checked it out with a scan, checked it out himself, and then was charged a convenience fee. So these types of fees are getting sort of out of control. There's no real way to justify them as a benefit other than it is providing a little bit higher bottom line for the business itself.
Thank you. Senator Tobin?
Thank you.
I wasn't sure if that was a request or not. So.
Yes, I'm curious, and thank you, Senator Kawasaki, for bringing this legislation before us. I myself have been wondering about some of the things that are tacked on to things like my Venmo or potentially to my Cash App. I know that recently Congress repealed the law that was to protect consumers. There would be transparency. Would this affect those types of additional fees, or at least provide some clarity as to what I'm being charged?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. Senator Tobin, yes, this would address some of those issues. The Federal Trade Commission was actually very aggressive with this a couple years ago under the prior administration and the one before that, where they were actually watching consumer and making sure that there's transparency in transactions like that. This current administration has sort of dropped it. So there's less, I think, from the federal level to do what we'd like to do. That's why this is needed now more than ever.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. May I ask, what are the penalties under misaction underneath this particular statute change? How would we keep the Venmos and the Cash Apps and such honest?
Through the chair, this is Joe Hayes, Senator Stafford, Senator Kawasaki. I will have to get back to you with that answer.
So I'd actually ask for a little clarity as to the bank's 3% fee today. So I go to the store, and typically the big stores may have a better bargaining level than others, but it's a practical matter. The 3% fee that's part of the bank card fee, does that mean that if I keep buying lots of things with a bank card, does that mean I'll start seeing a 3% add-on to the price I'm paying, because that standard bank fee is considered one of these junk charges? Or would that one not be included, and how do the regulators tell the difference?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, this is Joe Hayes after Senator Kawasaki. It wouldn't be considered a junk fee if it's a known price up front. So that would be the difference. You're paying a 3% fee. You didn't know you were paying a 3% fee until you actually use your card and say, oh, by the way, do you want to pay $2 to use this for the privilege of using this card? So you would know this up front. It's the upfront rationale that makes a fee either junk or not for the purposes of this legislation.
So, but I'll follow up on that. So does that mean we'll use $100? It's easier to do the math. Okay. I'm at $100 and I'm at the lumber yard and I'm buying $100 worth of lumber. Does that mean, and I pay with a credit card, does that mean that I just pay $100 on the credit card, or I'll get asked a question before I pay, do you want to add the $3 to pay for the credit card? And then I either say yes or no.
So this is through the chair, this is Scott Kawasaki. So if you were asked about the fee, and if you assumed that the fee was something that you should pay and you paid it, you probably shouldn't have paid it. If the because
all
what
right,
we're
Senator
trying
Gower
to do
talking,
is
I'm lost. I'm standing at the counter, and I bought $100 worth of lumber, and I want to pay with a credit card.
So as a business who takes a credit card, I'm not supposed to recoup that fee. That fee is my contract with the credit card company. So I'm selling something to you for what I'm selling it for, not the extra 3% that gets tacked on to me as the owner, business owner. That's my own transaction fees. So actually, if you look at your credit, if you own a business and you look at your credit card, your contract with the company is that you're not going to add that over to somebody else. That the amount of cost for a product is your amount for the cost of the product, not the extra amount that a credit card company costs that transaction. So you're not supposed to add that.
So if I'm the lumber yard in this example, mm-hmm. and I want to charge claimant $100 for the lumber, I, as the lumber yard owner, I eat the 3% and I don't charge him because that's my agreement with the credit card company that I don't get to add it on.
Through the chair, yes. That's how I understand how credit companies work, how credit card companies work, and the contracts between the owner, the business owner, and the credit card company. And it's the fees that's how a credit card company makes money.
And just, I know Senator Stevens is the only person at the counter that doesn't have an interest in this anymore. But
I'm just wondering if you're an airplane pilot. That'll change everything. <you know? laughs>
Mostly I wanted to be a tanker captain and bring my wife on vacation while I'm working. Senator Stevens, as one who's not running for re-election, you're the only one that doesn't concern, but to the extent those that run for office and have credit card contributions in this, which affects most of the folks in the legislature, what this bill does doesn't suggest that we would now need to start charging for a $100 contribution. We wouldn't have to charge them $103 because our agreement with the credit card company is we eat the $3. We pay the bank, the credit card company, $3. We collect $97, and the charge that shows up is $100.
Through the chair, that's correct. And mm-hmm. I think as a candidate, you can ask for any amount. Doesn't mean you're going to get it.
All right. Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'll just note that in the days when we had individual contribution limits, you couldn't have somebody tack on the cost of the stamp to their contribution for you if it took them over the $500 limit. But I guess actually that kind of leads into the question for the sponsor, which is mechanically, how does this language work for disclosure or of fees? I think about my telephone bill. It has so many lines on there. I mean, there's just, on the other hand, before I pay every month, I know exactly how much it is and what each thing is for. Is that offering a price that doesn't include all the mandatory fees and charges because they gave a price and then they separately included all the fees and charges? Or because we came to a total at the bottom of the bill, are they good? And I guess the same question sort of applies to that example of various kinds of junk, what are being called junk fees in the supporting document Mr. Hayes referenced. If a restaurant menu discloses lots of extra fees and charges, are they okay? Because I knew them, should have known them before I ordered? Or do they just need to offer me a price? How does the language in the bill affect those two things?
So through the chair, just looking over some of the materials that we provided the committee, I think that, for one, telecommunications is very regulated. It's a regulated industry through the Regulatory Commission. So there are folks that look at that. In particular, though, there are questions that have come up in various states about whether an administrative charge or regulatory charges that are added are actually government mandated. And so in those cases, some of those have been ruled illegal or out of order in those particular states. And I think in our state, since those telecommunications are heavily regulated by the RCA, that there's probably some consumer protections that have been established by the RCA on those particular bills that you might find. But what we're trying to do with that is not just cell phone bills, not just telecommunications, but pretty much any bill that you get with any transaction with any business, we want to try and get away from those junk fees.
All right. I don't see any other questions for the bill sponsor or his staff. So we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 241. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Hearing and seeing no one, is there anyone online wishing to testify? Hearing and seeing no one, we're going to close public testimony on House Bill 241. Any final comments from the sponsor's office before we set the bill aside?
Through the chair, Scott Kawasaki, for the record, I just wanted to thank the committee for taking a look at this bill, and we will have some testimony forthcoming.
Thank you very much. I don't see anything further. Committee, we're going to set Senate Bill 241 aside for further review, and we're going to adjourn for the day. If you are considering an amendment to either House Bill 93 or only House Bill 93, there's not a second bill. House Bill 93, Residence Requirements, Hunting, Trapping, and Fishing, sponsored by Representative Hinstreet. Please let our office know and to submit them electronically by Wednesday, March 18 at 5 p.m. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, March 18 at 1:30 p.m. And with that, we stand adjourned. The time is now 2:26 p.m.